G'day everyone. Welcome to Australian PI Podcast, Episode 3, coming to you from the headquarters of Colloque Investigations. I'm Natalie, and I should start today by apologising for the delay in getting this PI podcast out to you. It's been several weeks since my last podcast, and for those of you who have been waiting with bated breath for the next edition, I do apologise. I'm sure there are thousands of you out there who are just hanging for the next episode. Ha ha ha. Anyway, look, we love hearing from you guys, so, you know, I'll just start this by saying, by all means, drop us a line if you have any ideas about what you'd like to hear on this podcast, and if you have any feedback on anything that I've said in any of the podcasts, we'd love to hear from you. You can contact us on our email, admin@cloakinvestigations.com.au. Or on Facebook, just search for Colloque Investigations on Facebook. You can send us a message there or post on our wall. You can tweet us at Colloque PI, CLOAKPI. Or you can jump on our website, www.cloakinvestigations.com.au, and send us a message via our website. So as I say, we love hearing from you, we love feedback, and we love ideas on what sorts of topics you'd be interested in hearing about. Now, for anybody who's been listening in so far, the last two episodes, as you know, have been aimed at people who are thinking about getting into the industry, people who are wondering whether it's for them or not. So this episode is the next step. This is for those who have listened to those previous two and decided, yep, this is the career for me. So this episode is going to be all about how to set up your business, how to go about getting started as a PI in the industry. So without further ado, I'll get started. Now, setting up your business, getting started as a PI, it's a pretty simple process. You know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. You know, it's just a matter of, you know, going out, getting your qualifications to begin with. Now, you know, you just have to sign up for a course. There are lots of courses available in Australia. A lot of the TAFEs do courses. What you'd be looking for is a Cert 3 in Investigative Services. That's the course you'll be looking for. You can do it online for people who are sort of living more remotely and not living in the major centres or near a training institution. You can certainly find some really good courses online. But I do recommend if you are able to get to a course at a TAFE or similar, I think, you know, you're going to get a slightly better experience because you're going to have that face-to-face contact with your tutors and your lecturers. You know, you're going to be able to get that sort of anecdotal feedback and ask a lot more questions too as the course progresses. I mean, the online courses do provide you with the ability to communicate with your tutors and to ask questions, and by all means, I strongly suggest you do that. But you know, I do think that the practical courses, the practical courses do give you a lot more in-depth information and a lot more practical experience. But certainly not dissing the online courses, because there's some very good ones out there, and they certainly prepare you more than adequately for this career. So once you've gone and done your course, that usually takes about 12 months on average. With the online courses, obviously, you can do them as quickly as you want to. So, you know, I know someone who completed the course in 3 months. So provided that you've chosen a good online course and they're responding to your, you know, they're marking your work, you know, fairly promptly. Yeah, you can do it as quickly as 3 months if you're motivated to do so. So once you've got your Cert 3 certificate, you then have to approach the licensing body in your state. I can only speak from a Queensland perspective. In Queensland, it's the Office of Fair Trading, and you'll be applying for a security license. In this state, private investigators are licensed under the Security Providers Act. So even though you're not a security guard, as such, you're still coming under the same licensing regime. So go to your Office of Fair Trading. You can apply, you can download the forms online. I'm pretty sure it can all be sort of done online. And, you know, complete your forms, send in your certificate. And I think you have to send in like a statement of attainment, which is a list of the course modules that you did as part of your course. Oh, that's a bit of a cautionary tale too. I did hear of someone who did an online course and the course wasn't up to date with the latest changes in the licensing requirements, and a couple of the modules, one of the modules that was required wasn't included in the course, and when the person went to get their license, they weren't eligible. So just make sure that the course that you choose contains all the course units that you need. They're all listed on the Office of Fair Trading website in Queensland, and you can see exactly what you need to complete. The course module numbers are on there. So just make sure you match those up with the course that you're doing to make sure that all of those modules are present in that course. So once you get your paperwork off to the licensing body in your state, you'll usually be sent a letter asking you to make an appointment to go and get your police check done and your fingerprints done. So you'll need to be able to pass a police check and to get your fingerprints taken. If there is anything in your past and you're concerned about whether you'll pass the police check, there is information, I know for a fact, on the Office of Fair Trading website about what sorts of offences would exclude you from becoming a private investigator. They usually involve offences such as fraud, those sorts of offences. If you're a current bankrupt, I think that may also exclude you. If you're currently bankrupt, if you're discharged from bankruptcy, I don't think it matters. But don't quote me on that. Check it out. But it's all on the website, on the Office of Fair Trading website. Sorry, guys in other states, I can't speak for other states. I haven't done my research there, so you'll have to just go online and see what you can find out. So once you've had your police check done and you've got all your forms in, you've had your fingerprinting done, etc., etc., and provided there are no impediments to you getting a license, they will send you out your nice little license card with your mugshot on it in the mail, and then you'll be able to start legally operating as a private investigator and receiving money in return for your investigative services. So that's pretty exciting. And, keep that in your wallet, always a good idea. There are situations where you'll possibly be approached by police while you're on surveillance, while you're out on the job. So it's good to be able to produce a license if requested. I've been approached by police on numerous occasions when I've been on surveillance, and I've never been asked for my license. They usually want to see my driver's license, but they never seem to ask for my PI license. But in saying that, I'm not saying that that's not going to happen to you. So yeah, keep your license handy on you at all times when you're working. So that's your first step. I mean, you've got your license, you've done the course, you've done your training, you know the basics about how to go about things. The next thing you need to do before you start work is get your equipment. A lot of PIs kind of say, okay, well, I'll get a camera and I'll gradually build up the rest of my kit as I start going along and as I start bringing some money in. That's all well and good, and look, you can do it that way to a large degree. I mean, there's a vast array of technology out there that you could invest in to make your job easier and to be more efficient, but that's just not practical when you're starting out to go and buy a huge kit of stuff that you're not even sure you're going to use. But there are some fundamental things that you need to have in your kit bag before you start in this industry, and I really believe that. I really think that you need to get your equipment squared away before you do your first job. The reason for that is that you need to get yourself really familiar with your equipment, with all its faults, all its quirks, all its features, before you are on the job and needing to use those features. So, you need to spend time practicing with your equipment, knowing what it does, understanding what it does and how it can work for you on the job. I mean, particularly like with your camera, you don't want to be sitting in a car in the dark trying to find a setting on the camera that you should, you know, basically you should already know where it is and you should be able to operate it in the dark. You know, really at the end of the day, your camera is almost needs to be an extension of you when you're on the job in those circumstances, and you need to be able to operate your equipment in the dark when there's no light to assist you. So, you know, you need time to practice with your stuff, and you know, before you need it for real. So get some equipment together. Now, there's some basics that you need. I mean, there's lots of fancy stuff out there that you can collect over time if you feel you need it. But these are your basics, and these are the things that you should start your career with. A camera, of course. Now, you can buy a really great camera for under $500. You don't need to go and spend $2,000 on a camera that has all the gadgets. You know, as long as your camera has very good zoom capability, has good steady shot capability, which means that when you're on full zoom, it's not shaking around wildly. As long as it has decent video recording capability and a few good SLR features, you know, a few good manual features so you can adjust your focus and adjust it for different light conditions and those sorts of things, you know, you're away. You know, it's really as simple as that. You do not need a professional photographer's camera because you're not a professional photographer. What you are is somebody who is trying to capture images, but quite often those images are being captured through bushes, from long distances in low light conditions. So you need a camera that's going to do those things for you quickly and easily. So I mean, my preference is your SLR camera with your auto features so that you can manually adjust it when you need to, but it's also got the intelligent auto features that a lot of the cameras come with these days, where it automatically detects the conditions and selects the settings that it needs for those conditions. Getting a straight video camera is fine. I mean, they take pictures these days. Most of the handy cams around will take pictures, but you don't have that same ability with most of them to adjust your settings for good picture quality, and they don't have the zoom capability that that an SLR camera has. So generally, I would recommend going for something like that. Sony and Canon do very good quality brands these days. Sony used to be, I guess, a leader in the video side of things, but they've actually brought out some really good SLR cameras that I can highly recommend from personal experience. So get your camera. You're going to need a hidden camera. A little mini DV hidden camera. Now, these aren't expensive. They don't need to be expensive. I mean, you can spend several hundred dollars on one of these, but you can also pick up a perfectly good one for $50. So you've just got to shop around. My suggestion would just be ask around other PIs. What do they use? What do they recommend? You know, because it's trial and error, and you know, some brands are really great, other brands are terrible. You need one of these because if you're on surveillance and your subject gets out of the car and goes into a shopping centre or goes somewhere where you need to follow them on foot, you can't be whipping out your SLR camera and you know, it's too obvious. Obviously, you need to be covert. So having a little hidden camera handy, ready to go, is definitely a must. And you know, probably one of the most versatile forms that you can buy one in is the keychain. It just looks like, you know, one of those things that opens and unlocks cars. You can put a little key on it to make it look authentic, and they work really well, and they have good audio and good video, so they're quite good. But you know, they come in all sorts of forms. You know, watches, pens. You can insert them. You know, you can install them into a backpack or a handbag. You can have them in your shirt, as it just looks like a button on your shirt. There are so many different forms that you can buy hidden cameras. But I think out of all of them, and I've used most of them, the keychain camera is the most versatile and easy to use. So have one of those in your kit. Have it charged and ready to go. Chargers. Speaking of chargers, you definitely need to have chargers for your equipment while you're in the car. So you need to have a car charger for your camera. You need to have a car charger for your phones. You need to have a car charger for your hidden camera. So you can just, you know, obviously buy one of those USB adapters that just goes into your cigarette you know, socket in your car. You can buy dual adapters. You can buy fast chargers that charge up a lot quicker. But you need those because on the job, you know, you don't want to be worrying about battery life for your equipment. So you need to be able to charge everything that you have in your kit bag needs to be able to be charged in the car while you're out and about. Look, it's really handy to have an iPhone or a smartphone. You know, I'm a big fan of the iPhone. I think it's fantastic. And, you know, so many PIs are, you know, enjoying the benefits of the iPhone technology while they're out on the job. I mean, you can send photos instantly. You can take photos fairly surreptitiously without anyone noticing. You know, you can send emails, you can do a whole range of things. So an iPhone or a smartphone of some sort is pretty important. You can download, you know, apps to suit what you're doing, a voice recorder app or whatever you need. So, you know, a really handy little piece of equipment to have. A GPS for your car, you know, sat nav, that's an essential. When you're following someone, it is really great to A, know where you are, and B, be able to plot alternative routes and things like that. So one of those is just makes your life so much easier. So definitely get a TomTom or something like that for your car. Make sure you get really familiar with how to use it so that you're not trying to figure it out while you're driving and having an accident. A tripod, you know, just a little tripod. You don't need a full-size one. A tripod or a monopod. Monopods are quite handy for when you're sitting in the car. You can even get little ones that kind of sit on your steering wheel and things like that if you want to, you know, if you want to go high tech. So, yeah, you know, it just helps you with you know, your steady footage. When you're on full zoom, it doesn't matter how steady-handed you are, there's going to be some shake. And so your tripod is good for those situations just to minimize that movement. So, yeah, definitely invest in a small tripod or monopod. You need a voice recorder of some description. These are always handy for when you're having to do interviews with witnesses, etc., and also just for taking notes while you're on the go. You don't always have time to pick up your notebook and pen and write something down, but you can easily click the record button on a voice recorder and just note down the time and what's happening at that point in time. Makes it a lot easier when you get back to the office at the end of the day and you need to write your report and put in your investigation logs. So having a little voice recorder handy there in the car with you is fairly important. And of course, last but not by no means least, you need a surveillance vehicle. Now, you know, the ideal surveillance vehicle is nothing fancy. You want something that is obviously is reliable mechanically. But it needs to be something that doesn't stand out and that you're not too worried about damaging, because, you know, you might have to take this thing down dirt roads, through the bush, whatever the case may be. And you know, you might also be in a situation at some stage where your subject busts you and they get a bit irate and you don't want to be worried about them damaging your paint job when they come out with a baseball bat swinging. So you just need to have a little dunger of a car. Doesn't have to be anything spectacular. It does probably need to have a bit of power if you're following someone. Not that I advocate breaking road rules, I do not, but sometimes having, you know, a V6 or something like that is going to be more advantageous to you when you're trying to follow someone who is a bit of a lead foot, or you're trying to catch up to someone through traffic. So, you know, we use a Commodore, and it's brilliant. It's white. There's a million of them on the road, and they don't sort of attract any attention whatsoever. And we really don't care if it gets a bit beaten up because it's old anyway. But we keep it well maintained. We make sure that the thing is gonna go when we need it to go. We don't need it breaking down in the middle of a job. So so definitely, you know, whatever you get, make sure that it's mechanically sound and that you keep it well maintained. So they're your sort of basic items that you need to be able to do the work and get those organized before you start work, so that you're ready to go and you can hit the ground running. The next thing you need to do is kind of set up your business setup. You need to decide what sort of business setup you want to do. You can set up as a sole trader or you can set up as a company. It really depends what you envision your future to be. If you're happy just subcontracting and doing your own thing, sole trader situation is probably the best thing for you. Although a lot of nowadays, due to changes in taxation law, a lot of larger firms are kind of scared of hiring sole traders, because if you're only working for one company, you can be classed as an employee and not a subcontractor, which means you are entitled to standard employee entitlements. So they prefer to, a lot of companies or the larger firms prefer to hire people who have a PTY limited, who have a company, because it's harder for you to argue that you are an employee of their company if you have your own company. It's still not impossible though, and there have been precedents set where companies, people who have companies have argued successfully that they are an employee of a firm, because that the firm is the only employer that they have. So just be cautious there about how you set yourself up. Setting yourself up as a company is a lot more costly, and your accounting costs are going to be higher because you have to report to ASIC, and there's a lot more involved with your tax reporting than there is if you're a sole trader. Get yourself a good accounting program, MYOB or Xero. They all operate now in the cloud, so you can access them from wherever you are, and they're really quite simple to use these days. They're very user-friendly, so definitely get yourself a good accounting program, and get yourself a decent office setup. So, you're going to need a desk, you're going to need a phone, probably a fax, or a decent computer, and a filing cabinet that locks, and that's where you're going to be storing confidential information. You need to, keep in mind that the stuff that you're going to be dealing with is going to be confidential and private, and you need to have some sort of privacy policy or some sort of policy in place about how you store that information and how long you store it for. But I can go into all of that stuff at a later date. You need to think about your pricing policy. What are you going to charge for your services? Bit of research, do a bit of research around your area. What people charge, it varies depending on whether they're in a metropolitan area or a rural area. So have a, talk to other PIs, find out what's being charged out there in the industry, and then set your price accordingly. Don't try and undercut everybody, because it just drives the price down for everyone. But be reasonable, and quite often, being the cheapest doesn't always get you the job. So keep in mind that sometimes, people are looking for quality. So if you're too cheap, they might think that you're cheap and nasty. So just be careful with your price setting and things like that. But if you're subcontracting, then generally the person that you're subcontracting to is going to set the price anyway. There's not much room for negotiation usually where that's where that's concerned. The big firms set their price for subcontractors, and you've got to either take it or leave it. But if you're working for private clients, you can set your own price. And I strongly recommend that you also ask for payment up front where possible, because private clients are notorious for not paying, especially if they don't get the result that they expect to get. So you need to have a good client agreement in place too when dealing with private clients, so that it sets out very clearly what your capabilities are. It sets out what your client expects to try and achieve, but it also sets out the fact that you do not guarantee a result. You can very rarely guarantee a result when it comes to investigative work. You can guarantee that you'll do everything in your power, legally, morally, and ethically, to achieve what they need you to achieve, but you cannot guarantee a result. Make sure you have that in writing. People have unrealistic expectations, thanks to programs like CSI, as to what we can do and what we're capable of doing. So they need to have, there needs to be something in place to protect you. Get that payment up front wherever you can, or at least get a retainer so that you're not out of pocket if they decide not to pay you the rest. you also need to promote yourself, obviously. You need to let people know once you're open for business that you're open for business. So, you know, definitely sending your resume out there with a cover letter. Keep it concise. Don't include detail that isn't relevant to what you're doing. Definitely include detail in relation to previous careers where the skills are going to be of use to you in this new career. So if there are skills that you've attained in previous lives, then definitely include those if they are relevant to what you're doing today. But you don't have to talk about the first job you got out of high school, where you went to high school, any of those things anymore. People just want, you know, a clear and concise CV listing the skills that are going to be relevant to the job that you're going to be doing for them. Send a cover letter with it and try to tailor your applications to the company that you're applying for. So many people make the mistake of just sending one pro forma letter out to everyone. Recruiters can tell that it's a pro forma. They can tell that you've just, you know, stuck their name on the top and sent it out. If you can tailor it a little bit to the company that you're applying for, do a little bit of research on that company. I know it takes longer and it's more time consuming, but it will pay dividends in the end. Ideally, you want to be working subcontracting to several companies, not just one. So you need to send it out there to as many as you can. Expect to not hear back from a lot of them, but you will hear back from someone sooner or later, and you'll get started. And once you get a name for yourself and a bit of experience going, you'll be amazed how much work starts flowing in. Now, that's the other thing, I suppose, is experience. You know, a lot of the courses that you do try to give you practical experience because they recognize that that's going to assist you to get a job at the end of the course. But it doesn't hurt while you're waiting to get that job, that first job, going and doing a bit of work experience with firms that will accept you for that. It always helps. It's a great way to get your foot in the door and to get to know the people in the industry as well. So I highly recommend trying to do a bit of work experience. It'll be unpaid. It'll be probably be a thankless task, but at the end of the day, it will pay dividends for you if you can show that you're dedicated, you're determined, and that that you're keen. When jobs become available, you'll be the first in line to get it. So that's the basic rundown on how to get started in the industry. I've probably forgotten things, so please forgive me if I have. But that's the basics, and you know, I think if you do those things, you'll be up and running before you know it, and you'll be starting on your new and exciting career as a PI. Well, as I said in the beginning, if you guys have got any questions, any feedback, any suggestions about what you'd like to hear on these podcasts, by all means let us know. We always love to hear from you. And I'm hopefully going to be back in the next couple of weeks with the next edition. So I'll say bye for now and see you soon.